welcome to Travel Fun. My name is Mary Beth Clementi, and I am the host of this talk show on travel. And travel includes food and wine and sightseeing and all kinds of great things. And this week we're talking about wine. And I have Ben Carter on the phone, a.k.a. Benito. Ben writes Benito's Wine Reviews. It's a wildly popular wine blog. And in fact, he just celebrated his 1,000th anniversary. That means 1,000 posts on his blog since 2005. So this is a guy who knows a heck of a lot about wine. I'd like to welcome Benito to Travel Fun. Hey, Ben, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, and good evening, Colorado.
Yes, yes. I should say you're on the phone from Memphis.
Indeed.
And you explained to me earlier that you have no formal background in wine, and it just goes to show that if you apply yourself, you can learn all that you want, and just breezing through the hundreds and hundreds of posts on your blog, you certainly know a lot about wine. So how did you become such a wine aficionado?
Well, I sort of fell into it by accident. A childhood friend of my father's ended up becoming a gourmet chef and then got into the wine business as a distributor. And so in high school, I actually had the opportunity to taste some really good wines and to try some really good things in a normal sort of tasting environment. And so by the time I was 21, I had no desire for the standard, you know, 21st birthday, drink as much tequila as you can and then pass out kind of thing. I actually spent my 21st birthday at a legitimate wine tasting and tasted good wine. I took a few years off in terms of my interest in it, and really sort of rekindled an interest in wine in 2004. I had been to Europe, spent a couple of weeks in Italy, and had sort of learned what a normal wine culture was like in terms of it's not something for special occasions, it's not something just to say for an anniversary, it's just an everyday normal part of life, and I was very curious. And so in order to keep track of notes in terms of what I liked or what I didn't like, I just set up a blog just to keep notes. Didn't think anybody would read it, but people started reading it, so.
And 1,000 posts later, the rest is history, as they say.
Oh, yes. And it's also very funny. I started out sort of anonymous, not that I was ashamed of anything. I didn't think it was anything important. And so funnily enough, my first readers and fans were not from the United States or even Tennessee, but we're all from England and Australia. And I was kind of amazed by that. Like, wow, you know, I have fans in Australia. And so it was about a year or two before anybody locally noticed it. And then, you know, things blossomed from there.
Your cover was blown.
Oh, yes.
Talk about some of the things you blog about at Benito's Wine Reviews.
Well, I guess the first thing is that I don't really restrict myself simply to wine. I used to be a corporate trainer, and so I traveled quite a bit. And so if I was somewhere interesting, I would write about where I was there. You know, I also write a considerable amount about food. I've written about cigars in the past. I do book reviews occasionally. Sometimes I do a movie review. You know, I find it's helpful to sort of break up the routine, you know. I love writing about wine, but sometimes it's helpful to write about something else. I also write about cocktails a good bit, particularly the history of them, and certain obscure ingredients like bitters, for instance.
What are bitters made of?
Well, bitters can be made of just about anything. They're if you think about vanilla extract like you use in the kitchen, think about vanilla extract as being like vanilla bitters. Even though it's not bitter itself, it is a highly concentrated extract that is suspended in a great deal of alcohol. And it's used to give a little note to, say, making cookies or a cake. Bitters were extremely popular back in the 1800s. And they were added to cocktails. And so what you would do is you would shake a little bitters into your cocktail, and they could be celery bitters or cola-flavored bitters or cherry-flavored bitters or orange-flavored bitters or whatever else. And then what happened is after Prohibition, they kind of fell out of popularity. People forgot about them. They're just now having a resurgence. And so it's very exciting because there are a lot of great bitters out there on the market right now. My personal favorites are the ones from Fee Brothers out of Rochester, New York.
So basically, bitters are an extract.
Yes.
And they can be of different flavors. So.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I have ones that are rhubarb flavored and plum flavored and chocolate flavored and everything you could possibly imagine. And very few of them are actually bitter.
Wow. There we learned something.
The curiosity of the English language, though.
So. You mentioned something to me in a Facebook posting that I'm really embarrassed I haven't had the chance to try, but although I have some Pinot Grigio in my fridge, so maybe when I go home tonight I can try, you suggested I try a glass of Pinot Grigio with some cocktail onions or little cornichons. Talk about that.
Cornichons? I happen to be, in that particular instance, I was trying an Italian Pinot Grigio with pickled okra, which is sort of a regional delicacy around here and is not very well liked elsewhere, I don't think. But there was something about the hot and spicy and piquant flavor of the pickled okra that just matched up perfectly with the Pinot Grigio.
I do want to try that, and I'm actually thinking it might work even best with a wine that's sort of a day or two old.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. That's lost its zip. That's a way to put some zip back into it. What are some of your favorite wines?
Well, whenever people ask me this, I always say it completely depends on what I'm eating and what time of year it is. And the reason why I'll say that is that I love all kinds of wines and all different styles. But, for instance, the summers here in Memphis are extremely hot. And when it's extremely hot outside, I don't really want a big, heavy, oaky red wine. I tend to prefer a dry rosé from the south of France or a lighter white wine from Spain or something like that. In the winter, I absolutely adore things like port and sherry and some of the darker fortified wines that are out there. And again, also, sometimes it has to do with what I'm eating for dinner. You know, I had lamb last night, and so I had an opportunity to have an amazing Sonoma Cabernet Sauvignon with that. So, again, it's very situational. But the good thing is, and I always encourage people to taste as many wines as you possibly can. You won't like most of them, or you may like a lot of them, but you'll kind of figure out what you like and what you don't like. But the important part is to try as many as you can.
And are you... Do you have a penchant for one country over another? For example, some people say, oh, you know, I love California Chardonnays and, you know, or red wine has to be from France. Or
no. I am extremely open. I am willing to give anything and everything a fair chance and a fair evaluation. So I will tell you, I've tried wine from something like 25 different countries and about 17 different states in the United States, including Colorado, a lovely wine, Cabernet Franc, that was from near Grand Junction, Colorado.
Do you remember the house, the vineyard?
Plum Creek, I believe, was the winery. The thing is, I mean, I've had a pineapple wine from Hawaii, and
wow.
You know, I've had muscadine wine from Mississippi, and I've had a lot of different things. In terms of looking internationally, I've had wine from the former Soviet states of Georgia and Belarus. I've had wine from Turkey and Israel and Lebanon. I've had wine from India. I'll tell you a couple of areas that are sort of up and coming that have been making wine for thousands of years but are just now getting some more attention are Austria, Bulgaria, and Greece. All three of those countries are making some phenomenal wines these days, and they haven't been popular for the past 150 years, but are just now sort of coming back up. And there's some really, really great stuff coming out of those countries.
Are they improving upon their winemaking? And the reason why I asked that was I heard about a year ago from quite an authority on Greek food and wine that, oh, no, the Greece really isn't known for their wine. And I was really surprised by that. But then after I tasted some, I understood why.
So. Well, I will tell you, there's a certain style of Greek wine called Retsina, which has pine tar added to it.
Yikes.
And that was a preservative method that was used back thousands of years ago and was used for a long time. Pardon me. If you're looking for a great Greek wine, and I can send you some links later, there are some fantastic ones by Boutari, the producer. And what you want to look for is things like Mosco Falero or Acertico. Those are both phenomenal. There's a small island called Santorini there in the Aegean Sea that has some great white wines, but they also have a phenomenal dessert wine called Vinsanto. And if you've ever had the Vinsanto from Italy, this is a very similar but separate product, and it's just amazing. And again, a thing with Greek wines is there's a lot of confusion, again, based on the Retsina with the pine tar, but also in marketing. Traditionally, it's been problematic because of the alphabet difference. And, you know, unless you live in a city that has a substantial Greek population that also knows a lot about wine, you probably haven't had a chance to be exposed to any good Greek wine. And the other thing that's great about Greece is that these really great wines I'm talking about tend to be $10, $15. I mean, you know, at most you're going to be paying $20, you know, for a really great Greek wine.
And they're fairly easy to find in the U.S.?
No. they are, in fact, not easy to find. Because what happens is, typically in wine shops, if there's anything that's out of the ordinary, off the beaten path, tends to be kind of thrown onto a shelf in the very back of the store where nobody can find it, where you find, you know, the really cheap wines and sort of the just crazy stuff and something that somebody had to take, you know, as part of a bad business deal. And they will just throw all of this onto one shelf, kind of jumbled up together. And so, but it's definitely worth checking out. And like I said, Boutari is a fairly well-known producer with pretty wide distribution.
How do you spell that, Ben?
In English, using English characters, it is Boutari. In Greek, it's spelled a little bit differently. I could go through that.
Oh, okay. No.
Mu, beta, alpha.
No, that's fine. Okay. I am visiting with Ben Carter, a.k.a. Benito. He writes Benito's Wine Reviews. Google that, and you'll pull up his blog and find all kinds of interesting posts about wine and other fine beverages and food and travels. We're going to take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to Travel Fun. I am visiting with Ben Carter on the phone from Memphis, and Ben writes Benito's Wine Reviews, a great blog on wine and much more. He just posted his 1,000th story. He's been at it since 2005. Ben, I would like to ask you some tips on reading a wine label. And the reason is, first of all, you suggested earlier that the best way to get to know different wines is to taste them. And surely that is a great way. And we all enjoy wine tastings. But I took a class on wine at one point when I was living in France. And I learned how to properly read a French wine label. And that has been invaluable in my experience of selecting wine. Now, I only really know about French wines, or it kind of spills over into most European wines. I would like you to give some tips on reading different wine labels.
Well, the first thing I will say is that if you're wanting to learn about reading wine labels, start easy and start with English. Which is going to mean New Zealand, United States, Australia, and then if you're looking at certain dessert wines, Canada. And the reason why I say that is because each of those countries have fairly simple-to-read labels that don't require a knowledge of the native language. Every country has its own scheme that they use for labeling wines, and particularly the European countries have a lot of laws that designate what can be on there and what has to be on there. Some of the French ones are very simple to read. Some are more complicated. In my opinion, the German ones are extremely complicated and way more wordy than they need to be. And I'm saying that as someone that speaks German fairly well. Even I find them confusing at times. But on the other hand, the Austrians have actually been producing English labels that are more easy to read. So what you're going to want to do is kind of get an idea for the style of grape that you like. Don't worry too much about the year, because that's going to vary a lot. You know, focus on a style of grape that you like, a particular producer, and something that's really, particularly here in the United States, something that's really helpful is if you find a wine that you like, look at the back label and see who the importer was, and then look for other wines from that same importer. And you can go to the importer's website, and they'll show their portfolio of wines. And the thing is that an importer tends to have a certain style or a certain palette, and if you can find an importer that matches your own preferences, then it's very easy for you. Then you know, hey, I need to look for this wine, this wine, this wine. And because these things are based on distribution and everything else, you're likely to find wines like that in your area.
All right. Well, that's a good tip right there. Anything else to add about deciphering a wine label?
Well, I guess the biggest hint would be don't assume that just because there's a pretty label that it's a good wine.
You mean we can't judge that book by its cover?
Ugly labels, and, you know, vice versa. And so, you know, sometimes, I mean, I've been susceptible to it myself. I love my dogs, but, you know, I have purchased a bottle of wine because it had a funny dog on the label, and I just thought it was neat, you know. So, but at the same time, you know, it's the old don't judge a book by its cover. The wine label has information, but bear in mind it is also marketing, and just because it has gold foil on it or a elaborate stamp doesn't mean it's necessarily a better wine.
Okay, well, that's good to keep in mind. Ben, you have a great sense of humor, I found, in just kind of scanning your blogs, and that always makes for an enjoyable read. And I came across this one post you have that's entitled Salmon on Car Engine.
Yes.
And you go on to explain how you do it. And I want to read part of this one paragraph you wrote here. It says, the 1993 Honda Accord has a cozy spot between the exhaust manifold's heat shield and the alternator. The Honda engineers were kind enough to label the heat shield with hot, stamped into the metal. The second law of thermodynamics dictates that an engine will produce waste heat. Normally, this disappears through the exhaust system or simple thermal radiation through the hood. However, the laws of physics don't prevent you from capturing some of that waste heat for culinary purposes. And you go on to explain how to make the salmon en papillote in your car.
Yes. Well, and the first thing I will say to the listeners is, please do not try this if you don't know what you're doing, because it is possible to actually damage or destroy your car engine. I grew up in the Boy Scouts and in various things, and my grandfather actually, on long road trips, would cook foods on the car engine. And so I had practical experience with that. Now, if anybody is interested in the subject of cooking on your car engine, there's a book called Manifold Destiny, and I don't remember the author's name, and it's also out of print, and so the out-of-print copies were very expensive. But it's an entire cookbook devoted to how to cook things on the car engine, and it tends to be easier with older model cars. The modern sort of engines they have in cars, it's not as convenient to do this kind of thing, but... It was a way to take a classical French preparation and put a little spin on it. And it's funny you mention that, because I actually made some en papillote last night, but did it in the oven and just using the parchment paper and more traditional with Meyer lemons and fennel and things like that.
Well, I think that's a great illustration of the fun that you have with your blog. And I tried to do the same thing with my blog, bonjourcolorado.com, mm-hmm. and I like to tell stories. I like to share information and be entertaining and informative and tell stories. So I certainly appreciate that with you. And by the way, I am going to be posting this on my blog, likely as a podcast, and that will be at bonjourcolorado.com. Ben... Do you write anything about wine tours on your blog?
No, I haven't really written anything about specialized package tours, simply because I haven't actually taken any, so I couldn't tell you about which ones work or not. I was invited to go through Sonoma on my own, visiting organic wineries, and that was something sponsored by a PR firm. And had an absolutely fantastic time in Sonoma. Beautiful place, and easy enough to just pick your wineries and go and have a great time. But I haven't written specifically about package tours or anything like that.
Well, it's great that you bring up organic wine. What are your thoughts on organic wines?
Well, so I will tell you there's some controversy out there regarding organic and biodynamic wines. Are you familiar with biodynamic wines?
Not really.
Okay. Biodynamic is sort of a level beyond organic that involves things like planting based on the phases of the moon and filling up a bull's horn with cow manure and planting it at midnight. And there's a lot of sort of unusual practices that are involved with it. The thing is that with any of these practices, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a better or worse wine. What you want to look for is the attention that the winemaker is giving to the wine. And what happens is, a lot of times with these organic or biodynamic wines, is because they're such small production and because they're spending so much time physically handling the vines by hand, you end up with some truly phenomenal wines. But it also doesn't mean that wines that aren't organic are lesser or anything else. It's just, you know, different things work for different farms. And because what we are talking about with wine is really farming, you know. And so the other thing to keep in mind is that there are some wineries that are doing amazing stuff, and they're completely green, and they have solar panels and windmills and everything else. But for one particular reason, they can't get the official organic certification. And so these wines will sometimes be labeled as sustainable, or they will be labeled with a different sort of like a regional name that's used. And so for me personally, it's not a decision that I use when I look at a wine, but I know that it is something that is very important to certain people that have decided either for their restaurant or at home to go completely organic. And so there is a great market out there for these products.
Mm-hmm. And I have to add that I'm now in what the French term a certain âge. And my own experience has dictated to me, and other friends in my age group have confirmed that, oh, yes, you know, stay away from cheap red wine. That's sure to give you a headache, even if you drink just a small quantity. And many women have gone so far as to recommend, oh, you should only be drinking organic wine. Have you heard much about that? Is this something I can inspire you to blog about?
Well, I will tell you that everybody has their own personal choices and their own personal preferences. And I once dated a girl that completely hated Chardonnay, claimed she couldn't stand it, would never drink it because she had a bad experience one time. And then one time she actually accidentally picked up a bottle of white Burgundy that I had lying out and thought it was just fantastic and thought it was great and wonderful, and she wanted more of it. And I couldn't bring myself to tell her that it was all Chardonnay. So there are psychological components. There's, in terms of what gives you a headache or what makes you feel ill or whatever else, the biggest thing is simple, being responsible, making sure you're fully hydrated, you know, not having the entire bottle before you go to bed, things like that.
Right. Now, so, that hydration is a key, particularly here in the Rockies, even for people who live here.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, you'll hear people that will say, well, you know, I've never had a problem with French wines, but Spanish wines just make me ill, you know. And there may be some cultural association there or, again, some bad experience from the past. And I'm not saying those are not legitimate complaints for that particular person, but, you know, there's no hard and fast rule about what's going to work or not work for a given person.
I would tend to agree with you on that. Well, thanks for the reassurance. Ben, as we speak, I believe that Ken Burns' new series, Prohibition, is airing on PBS. Do you plan on watching that?
I do plan on watching it, and I understand you interviewed Ken Burns recently, and I have enjoyed his previous documentaries. Prohibition is a fascinating subject, and I don't know what all is going to be in the documentary, but something that was surprising in the histories that I've read about it is how much winemaking still went on during Prohibition. In terms of, particularly in New York, the number of licensed priests and rabbis exploded overnight because they were allowed to purchase wine for religious purposes.
Oh, and very interesting.
There was also an exemption for home production of wine, that you were still allowed to make a certain amount of wine at home. And so there were a lot of California grapes that were shipped to the East Coast, where people, particularly in Philadelphia and New York and Chicago, were making wine at home using these grapes from California. And then there were wineries that were doing things like selling barrels of grape juice and saying, be careful, you know, if you let this sit for a couple of months, it'll turn into wine, and you don't want that to happen, so don't put it in the basement in a cool, dark place, you know. And there was a lot of, I mean, it was amazing how much wine production was still going on during this whole time, just sort of with a wink and a nod or sometimes with bribes that were involved. There's an excellent book called When the Rivers Ran Red. I don't have the author's name in front of me, but it is a great history of Prohibition, specifically about the Northern California wine industry.
Okay, I bet things became more artisanal during that time. I have been visiting with Ben Carter, a.k.a. Benito. Just Google Benito Wine Reviews, and you'll pull up his wonderful blog on wine and so much more. Ben, sadly, we've run out of time. Fortunately, I am going to be able to post this on my blog, bonjourcolorado.com, as a podcast in the near future. And look forward to writing about you there as well. Thank you so much for being a guest on Travel Fun.
Well, thank you very much, and à votre santé.
Ah, merci beaucoup. Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. You can use some exotic booze. There's a bar in far Bombay.